Here we go. That's it. Showtime Matthew Paul. All right, welcome everybody. We are 2 weeks and count 2 weeks plus, 2.5 weeks till the Seder. So it is not too early to begin getting ready. So if you are going to run a Seder or you want to be an active participant in the Seder, let's go through all the basics. You want to be
Oh,
a guest
Rabbi.
without, yes.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I took your advice. I went to Fairway on Sunday,
Oh, beautiful.
and they had the kosher for Pesach Heinz ketchup, which
That's
I
it.
got, which is awesome.
Yes.
So.
Very good. Okay, good. Yes, there's some good stuff to get out this year. All right, here we go. Let's get on and on. So, number one, failure to plan. Plan to fail. I mentioned that last week, and which means that if you want to come to your Seder and to be an active participant, you can't just walk in there with your Haggadah, blow the dust off it, and hope that magic's going to happen, because nothing in your life that you want a good return on, it works that way. You're making a major presentation to your to a client, to a boss. You got to work hard on that PowerPoint presentation. Work out your talking points. You got to do it right. Seder should be the same way. Seder is our Super Bowl of the year. It's Showtime at the Apollo, and you got to be ready. So, let's go for it. All right. I also recommend adding, if you have the influence, to add some games in the back. I'm gonna add my sheets. I'm gonna send it to everybody. I'll just drop it into the link over. I'll drop it into the chat. Yeah. So you do
Getting
this.
another fake dollars.
Yeah, fake file. Yes, yeah, so I'm going to. So I'm going to. It's not going to. Let's see if I can do this without. All right, so I'm going to. I'll post it on the chat. I'm not going to do this right now. It's going to make me get too long to do that. Okay. Sorry about that. Stop chat. Okay, hold on. Bear with me. Okay. Okay, so I have games, which I got from HaTorah, which I recommend if you want to bring one or two, especially if you got younger kids at the Seder and you want to add a little spice. I recommend that. You want to have fun. I have Seder dollars, which is the way I do it for my kids, and I run the Seder. I'm just going to fast forward to that so you can take a peek at that. Here we go. Just going down. Here we go. All right, Seder dollars. Going for the show. There you go. So Seder dollar, the way that I operate in my house is that if you ask a question, you get a Seder dollar. Good question. $2. You answer a question, you get a dollar. And you keep those dollars in your possession. And after Yontif, I changed those Seder dollars for regular American US dollars. So shall we say that's been a favorite for my in my Seder for many, many years. I recommend doing that. Next, very important. The problem is that people come to the Seder not hungry, hangry. Okay? So, and therefore, what kind of student or what kind of discussion is the person willing to do? Come on in, come on down. Welcome. What's your name? Zeke. Pleasure, pleasure. We're getting right into it. All right, we got to welcome Zeke. So, we are going through things for to enhance our Seder. Okay, so that's, we're going to move on up. All right, here we go. All right. So that's the way as far as the Seder dollars. Now, very important. People come to the Seder hungry. In fact, the number one question is, can we eat yet? That is typically the number one often frequently asked question at the Seder. Can we eat yet? And if you're dealing with people who are not hungry but hangry, it is helpful during the Maggid, the storytelling section of the story, is to actually do what? Is to actually give them some more additional snacks to curb their hunger. And as such, to not they're not supposed to have to eat a meal, but a little extra snacks, it does the body good. Now, what I want to share with you is a concept called a Seder nugget. What is a Seder nugget? So a Seder nugget is you, either the Seder leader or B, the Seder participant, you are going to share something to the table, which will be engaging to get move the conversation to the next level. So number one, it's got to be relevant. Number two has got to start with a good hook. Number three has got to be short. Nobody wants the long, drawn out anything at the Seder. Keep it moving is the magic words. Got to be meaningful and likely should have a story component. Okay? the key element, what is the, let me ask, I'll start with the first question of the night for you guys is reading the Haggadah and the mitzvah of Sipur, telling the story, one and the same thing? And what is the relationship one to another? In other words, is telling the story and reading the Haggadah identical, or they're different? And if so, how are they different? Yes, Eitan.
Well, I know when you do the Haggadah, you're supposed to feel like you left Yitzhak and you got Yitzhak yourself, like
Yeah.
you went from slavery to freedom. And
Yeah.
in that way, that is like Yitzhak. You are supposed to have the experience of
We're gonna do it. So there was so that so that's just reading the Haggadah. So is the mitzvah of Sipur anything different, or is that identical? The
part
part of it.
it's definitely everything.
No, the Haggadah is the springboard. It's there to open up the conversation, but really telling the story should be in your own words. And it should be, as I said, relevant to your crowd, engaging, conversational, and you should tell a story, in your own words, which will make an impact to the people in your around your table. If you're just reading the Haggadah, what is that in a simple English word? Boring! You got to make it compelling, interesting, fascinating, which is hard because problem was they went to a seder last year, and frequently they went to a seder the year before that. You got to bring some creativity, make it interesting. Okay, so that's the challenge. You got to make the old new. So you got to really so I'm going to share with you some tonight some seder. I'm going to drop some seder nuggets on you guys. So you guys will have. I have, in fact, I have a place to give notes. There are some pens on the table. You want to write that down. And therefore, you can have something to share at your Seder. And we outside Land of Israel don't do one Seder, but we do two Seders. So you'll have something for every night. Okay, here we go. Seder nugget number one. What is the top question about the order of the Seder that everyone is thinking but not asking at the Seder? Okay, question number one. So there, right, I have that written out there. Kadesh Urchas Karpas Yachatz, right? I have the Seder written out. What is something people are thinking about the order, but they're not asking? But they're thinking it, they're not asking it. What do you guys think?
Nora?
Well, no, that's
No.
not about the order. You're warm, though.
Why is the order Seder the one that is currently being used?
But specifically, what would people like to say? What were the other 14 steps of the Haggadah? What step would they like to see? What would they like? How would they like to rearrange the order? Eitan,
All right.
right? No, it's Kaddish, or maybe you'll do matzah like a regular Shabbos. We make Kiddush, we make a mochi on the challah. So switch out challah, put in matzah, Shulchan Aruch. And then over dinner, over the chicken
Next year in
coop,
Jerusalem.
right? And then we'll discuss them. We'll do
That
the Manashtana
sounds good.
on the Dayenu over the thing.
Right. We spent 3.5 hours sometimes in Jerusalem talking about the Magid section or more, and we're like,
Exactly.
haven't eaten. So
Right.
a little bit of food to
Right.
accompany. Exactly.
Right. Well, okay, but Tom, that's a 3.5 hour Magid. Most people's Magid is about 23 minutes. So they're cruising at a warp speed, or they're just doing the highlights, a little Manashtana and a Dayenu, and bring out the matzo ball soup. So the so the, all right. So the question is, since people, why would the so let's deal with the question this way. So why is Shulchan Aruch so late in the order? Or if you have your kiddush, you're washing your hands, eating the karpas, divide the middle matzah, tell the whole story, wash your hands again, eat the matzah, the mar, the hill sandwich, then you have the Shulchan Aruch. So why is it so late in the order?
Rabbi Pinney, I want to go back for a second. I
Yes.
didn't you were allowed to have snacks pre Shulchan Aruch, besides like the things you put out for the Seder. What like I know you can't have the matzah before the bracha, but are there snacks you can put out?
So once you make Kiddush, tet in order, they don't what we don't want a person to actually do the Shulchan Aruch. No, in other words, they don't want you, quote unquote, do pre-gaming. You know what I'm saying? But to some snack, like some people, for example, they'll do for karpas, they'll do potato. But there's no technical thing if they don't, if I have a person has a meatball, person has a little bit, you know, a kosher for Pesach Knish, a little additional snack. Yes, I'd rather them be lenient in having some additional snacking during the Maggid than basically unable to pay attention to the Maggid. You're right. A person should have a glass of wine, have their, you know, piece of celery, and then discuss the Seder, fine. And if you can do that, you should do that. But you don't want to lose, you don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good. Because if people are just hangry, then and they're not really discussing the story, then you didn't, then you lost. The main mitzvah is telling over the story and doing it in a compelling, interesting, engaged manner, not just somebody droning through the reading it at warp speed, and then, all right, we got, you know what I'm saying? You get, you know what I'm saying? So I don't know, while you may have an excellence of one area, the concern is the person's gonna get drawn into eating, and then they're gonna get sucked into snacking, and they're not gonna do the maggid. My concern is have a little bit more snacking, so they'll at least do the maggid, they'll do the story time in a meaningful way, instead of like racing through it so they can get to the matzo ball soup, you know, in 24 minutes. In fact, people, there are people that actually the next day, what do people, classic phenomena, what do people say first day of Pesach to other, what is the number one question that people ask on the first day of Pesach to other people when they see each other, like in shul, you know,
classic question. Wait, question or like the greeting?
And what part of the what is the number one question that people ask other people on the first? This is a sociological question. What is the number one question that people ask other Jews on the first day? In other words, the night, the day after the Seder. There's always one question.
How late did your Seder go?
How late or how long was your Seder? Now there's two. There are two bragging rights. Either A, you had the longest Seder. We did the Seder Sona. We actually finished at two in the morning. Two in the morning. We finished at three in the morning. Three in the morning. We just finished now. Okay, whatever. So people are just, you know, up, you know, like sort of like, you know, out trying to say. And then there's the opposite. What are you talking about? We wrapped that Seder up by 10:30, baby.
45 minutes.
Right. Oh. In other words, it's like a maggid, 18 minutes. Said every crazy word.
Crazy.
In Jerusalem.
Right. You know what I'm saying? So you have two bragging points, but they, okay, fine. So obviously, okay, so that's the point. So, Jamie, did I answer your question, Jamie? I think I did.
Jamie's on mute, yeah.
Well, yes and no. I guess my question was...
My answer in one sense is, it's not usher, it's not forbidden, it's not ideal, and I'd rather have being... People have a little more snacking, which is less ideal, and more learning, which is the goal. You know what I'm saying?
Are there any prohibitions on the snacks you can serve? Because the Seder is so...
Well, whatever the kosher to Passover. No, you can't. No, as you said, no matzah. You know, you could have a meatball. You're keto. You can have a keto-friendly meatball. And you could have whatever, you know.
No, I'm not going to do it on Seder because I have to have matzah. But no, right. I meant more in general because I know like the Seder is very ritualized. So like there's a certain order, like you have to have like karpas and then you have to have like.
So the karpas has to be something, you know, like a green. So it could be.
Right. But are there any prohibitions? Like are you not allowed to serve certain things before the meal?
No, you just can't start your meal, which would mean having your matzah now. That's an absolute no-no. Or B, having a whole plate of food, which will be your dinner. Those are the two absolute no-nos. But if a person has, a meatball, it's fine. You know what I'm saying? It's not a violation. Is it ideal? No. But my sharing tonight is that I'd rather, you know what I'm saying? Life is not. I'm trying to share it. Or you don't have two perfect choices. Or I'd rather them be less hungry, so which is, you know, and then B, more magid. I'm more, no, I don't, my more magid, meaningful magid, meaningful experience. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm arguing.
They usually have two things that happen. One, for the kids, especially, they have them take a nap in the afternoon, so they're up and ready to go and all fired up for the Seder, so they're not falling asleep early. And the second thing is that they give them, even around Karpas time, first of all, they'll give them food before everything starts. And then after that, during Karpas, they'll give them like a potato. They give everybody a potato. So if you give a certain amount of potato, not too much, but not too little, and that usually covers. And then you're ready to go. You're all excited and fired up.
So, Tom, if that's good enough for you, then that's what you should do. Also, with the halachas, if you give kids candy at the beginning of the thing, why? So she'll ask a question, like, why are we getting candy before the meal? That's all. That's one of the triggers. Okay, so the reason that we have a specific order and the magid is deep into the section is because the order is, like all orders, it's sequential. Let me give you some points. Here's some magid points. Number one, the main star of the night, of course, is the matzah. So you break the middle matzah, and that matzah functions as the prop. You lift it up, you cover it, you're discussing the matzah, correct? So therefore, when later on you're going to actually eat the matzah, you're in a position, you're thinking of the matzah not just as a cracker, but it's transformed as that which expresses the idea of freedom, that which expresses the idea of servitude. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you're actually qualifying the matzah to be something which is having an impact psychologically. Therefore, the magid, you talk about the matzah, then you eat it. Not only that, you have to discuss the idea of matzah, right, Gamaliel Omer? You have to discuss the idea of the mitzvah and then do the mitzvah. Normally, halacha has a low bar. What do I mean by low bar? If you pick up the lulav of a set, just pick it up, and you don't make a bracha, are you yotzei the mitzvah of taking the lulav on the first day of Sukkot? You just pick it up. You don't make a bracha. You just pick it up. Are you yotzei the mitzvah? Your biblical commandment to take the four species on the first day of Sukkot. You are 100% yotzei. Yes. Because brachos is a separate mitzvah. The rabbis made another mitzvah called making a bracha before a mitzvah, which you do. If you don't make a bracha, you're still yotzei the Torah mitzvah. And even if you lift it up in not a thoughtful manner, like you're not thinking about the idea of lulav, you're just picking up like a mechanical action, you're yotzei. So God is the Torah has a very low threshold to basically be involved. You just know that you're doing the mitzvah. I'm doing the mitzvah, well, boink, done. Now, is that the highest level doing the mitzvah? What do you think? No, that is one of the lowest level doing the mitzvah. It's a very, you want mitzvah to be a thoughtful, meaningful action. Not now, not just to do the mitzvah. Here, on the Seder night, we do mitzvah in a robust fashion. We discuss the mitzvah, we talk about matzah, and then we do the mitzvah matzah. So it's a fully intentional act. It's a mindful mitzvah. Ideally, you want your mitzvah to be done mindfully in the most highest level. On the Seder night, since it's the Super Bowl of the year, we're doing mitzvahs in the highest level. So we discuss the mitzvah of matzah, then we eat it. We discuss mar, then we eat it. You know what I'm saying? So that's another reason. Therefore, if you would just go to the mitzvah but without having the conversation part, you're going to miss all those elements, okay? Second of all, I'm going to ask a question. Tomorrow, you're at work. And your non-Jewish coworker wants to know, ask you a very basic question. What is the Seder? And you look at his eyes and you know that you have about 18 seconds to give them an answer. Beyond 18 seconds, they're not interested. They got 18 seconds of curiosity. What are you going to say?
Story of the Exodus of the Jews from Egypt.
That's what the Seder is? That's a myth of telling the story. That's not the Seder. The whole other, that's about one part of the one out of the 14 parts. How would you shrink it down? 18 seconds you got. You met that guy in the coffee room. His name is Joe. He's just curious. You heard about on the news that there's going to be Passover soon. They're having a Seder, and he is from El Paso, Texas, and he did not see a whole lot of Seders. And he didn't know what that is. So I would say like this. 18 seconds and less than 18 seconds. The Seder is our Thanksgiving, but we do it different because we discuss why we're thankful for first, and then we eat. That's the main thing. Because we have a whole conversation about the leaving of Egypt. And why we, because the main part of the Seder is praising God for being liberated. And as Eitan said before, not only liberation was then, it's still now. So the bottom line is that, you know, we, that's what it is. 18 seconds. In other words, I'll say it succinctly. Our Seder is our Thanksgiving celebration where we discuss our Exodus, the Exodus story, gain the appreciation, and then we celebrate with an unbelievable meal. That's it. And really, you tell the person a whole lot because, in essence, that's what really it is. Most Jews don't really know that. They just see it as a club. We do this, we have some matzah, we do some reading, sing some songs. They actually don't actually know what the, they don't really know essentially what they're really doing. It really is a Thanksgiving, it is a proper Thanksgiving meal. Questions or comments? Zeke, you give me some quizzical look there. What's tell me what your question is. Okay. So that's all right, good. So that's what the order is for. So that's our Seder nugget number one. Seder number one is that the order is sequential. You have to do, it's ideal to do in this order in order to maximize the Magid, the Matzah, the Maror, and then you have the Shulchan Aruch fits into that role as part of the celebratory evening. Okay. Any questions about that? We'll move on to number two. Questions? Comments? Show me set table. The table is set, ready to set for dinner. Okay. Yeah, I should have wrote the English. I'm gonna translate that briefly. So Kaddish is make the kiddush on the wine. Urchas, you wash your hands before having the wet vegetable. Karbas is you dip a celery or parsley or potato in the salt water. Yakash, you break in the middle matzah. Magid is telling the story over, reading through the text and discussing it. Rocks is washing your hands for the matzah. Motzi matzah is we have the three matzahs, we break them, and we distribute that. Everybody eats a kazayit, about an ounce of matzah while reclining. We're also going to have, it doesn't mention, we have the four cups of wine. Maror, you have the bitter herb. Karech is the hill sandwich. Shulchan Aruch is the meal. Tafun, we call the afikoman, it's dessert. And Barech is the benching, the Birkat HaMazon. Bahal is the praising. And Nirtza is, among Ashkenazic Jews, is a prayer that our service Seder is accepted by God. That's your basic Seder. Okay. Question? Comments? All right. Here, now we're going to talk a story. I'm going to read the story to you, and don't look at the answer. Can I say, in the morning we had a blessing called Shelo Asani Aved. Blessed are you, God, who did not make me a slave. Can I say, blessed are you, God, who did not make me a slave, as a slave to the Nazis? Here's the story. This is a thing that happened in 1941. We, the Jews of Kovno Ghetto, were completely enslaved by the Germans. We worked to the bone night and day without rest. We were starved and paid nothing. The German enemy decreed our total annihilation. We were completely dispensable. And in the end, most of us would die. One morning during prayer, Rabbi Avram Yosef, who was leading the congregation in the morning service, reached the blessing, who has not made me a slave, and shouted bitterly to the master of masters, how can I recite the blessing of a freed man? How can a hungry slave, repeatedly abused and demeaned, praise his creator by uttering, who has not made me a slave? Every morning, as Avram Yosef led the prayer, he let out the same cry, and many of those who joined in prayer felt the same way. I was then asked for a Torah ruling on this question. Should the blessing be omitted because it seemed to be a travesty, in which case it would be forbidden to recite it, because it's not true? Or was it forbidden to alter or skip any part of the prayer text established by our sages? Without looking at the English, what do you guys say? Should those Jewish slave part who are pressed into Nazi slave labor, should they make the blessing in the morning? Blessed are you, O God, King of the universe, who has not made me a slave. Eitan. So don't look at the. If you told me the answer, you're not okay. What do you say? Okay. I'll let somebody else a chance. Everybody in Zoom, what do you guys say?
So, Rabbi Pinney, I think slavery has two parts.
Okay.
One is physical and one is mental.
Okay.
So if they don't, there is a you could possibly be physically enslaved, but mentally you may not still identify as a slave. In Egypt, they had a slave mentality. They were slaves for generations. But in Nazi Germany, they lived full independent lives and were enslaved during the war. So in theory, they could be physically enslaved, but possibly not mentally enslaved, in which case you might be able to still say it. But otherwise, if you're both physically and mentally enslaved, then you probably could not.
Excellent point. So Jamie, let me push a little, let me probe a little further. What does it mean to be mentally, what's the measurement and metric of being mentally enslaved?
That it's a difference that mentally, for being mentally enslaved, you would not just view your slavery as temporary or conditional based on a particular situation, but your entire life would be seen as without autonomy and enslaved. So I think
What is
they
on,
would
but
not.
what's autonomy?
You have mental autonomy and physical autonomy. So if you believe that at some point that you were not a slave, you at some point when the war is over would then continue to not be a slave. I think mentally, and the fact that they're even questioning, is this in fact slavery and should we say this or not, means that they probably don't have a slave mentality where their entire life is viewed as pointless without autonomy. They had points in their life where they were autonomous, and in theory, feeling that at some point, if the war was won, they would again not be enslaved, then you may not have a slave. Yes, your physical circumstances may be that, but in reality, you are not a slave for all time.
That's an excellent point. We're going to get into that. I just want to pause right here. I want you to step into a third person perspective. Do you just notice the conversation that I and Gene were just having about the nature of slavery? That is a premium savior conversation. If your conversation has that kind of conversation, that's the gold standard of a seder. What we're doing now is define, well, what's the nature of a slave? For example, could a person be a slave to their work? Slave to fashion, slave to people's opinion. And when are you not that? It's not such a simple question. It's a hard question. Yes, eight time. Well, if you're saying human, but but no person is born a slave. But there are slaves. So the point is, what she's going to answer shortly is that really, that part of the celebration, just taking Jamie's point another step further. It's not simply that I had that the people who are in Lithuania can remember that 2 years earlier they had freedom of travel, freedom of movement, freedom of religion. Freedom for Judaism is actually the freedom of the soul, where you can choose to be a moral person. Whereas the Nazis can take away your money, can take away your clothes, can control what you're going to do, could put you into a penitentiary or a concentration camp, but they could not strip a truly a free person their free will and their ability to be a moral person. Give you an example. Those people, after they finished the services, would get onto a truck and be taken to a nearby factory run by the Nazis. So part of the issue would be a more example of a moral question would be that let's say the guy saw that the other person had the bread ration in his pocket, and all he had to do was, and he's starving, everybody's starving, was to reach into the guy's pocket and pickpocket out that bread ration. Should he do or not do it? And for his decision to not do it, a freedom of moral choice, that's freedom. He's acting, I'm applying the principles of my mind. The fact that the Nazis are forcing me to work does not take away my essential freedom. And the celebration of Pesach is we celebrate God taking us from our political freedom, out of the Alcatraz, which is Egypt, and endowing us with the dignity of free will and the capacity to live a moral life. And that nobody can take away from you. And that's real freedom. Yeah. Viktor Frankl.
It's all about that. It's all about, you know,
they believed and there was a higher good and there's a higher purpose and that added meaning to let them allow them to endure the worst conditions to be able to do it. So interestingly, so just to read the answer, this is what the Rabbi Oshri, who was the rabbi who was left in that circumstance, he said, one of the earliest commentators of the prayer pointed out that the blessing was not formulated in order to praise God for our physical liberty, but rather for our spiritual liberty, which I just explained. I therefore rule that we cannot skip or alter the blessing under any circumstance. On the contrary, despite our physical captivity, we were more obligated than ever to recite the blessing to demonstrate to our enemies that even if physically we were slaves, as a people, we remain spiritually free. So the point here, this is a good nugget. So now, rule one, do not read anything from a text if you want to do a good nugget. In order to say that you're doing an improv. Okay, you'll tell the story. Say, you tell them the story. Say, it's 1941. The Jews are in the Kovno ghetto. The Nazis have controlled the Jews and they're taking them to a work camp every day. They still allow the Jews to daven in the synagogues. One day, a guy named Avram Yosef asked right before the morning blessings, can I say the blessing? Blessed be you, God, King of the universe, who said, who did not create me a slave. Should he, when in fact they are nothing but slaves to the Nazi empire, should they say the blessing or not? Then you pause. I want to hear from you guys. Should the man say the blessing or not? And then let's say some people will say you should not say the blessing. Some people will say you do say the blessing. Okay, what's the reason? You get into a conversation. Then you already have gold standard Seder action going on there. You have a real. That because you have left the script. Let me use a jazz analogy. In music, in jazz specifically, you have the melody line, the simple melody. Then the jazz musician, guitarist, Wynton Marsalis, trumpet player, will then take the melody line and then will. In a gesture of improvisation, will go off on his own direction based upon it, but not controlled by that. So the Haggadah is talking about if we didn't leave Egypt, we would still be there. All talking about slavery left and right. Here you talk about you're right there, and then you're like leaving the script, baby. You have that kind of conversation. That's money. Now you may only get 5 to 8 minutes of that moment in your Seder. But that's but that already makes your Seder a different Seder. Instead of just reading wrote lines, you're having real music. You know what I'm saying? It's real music. There's a real it becomes a symphony of heart, soul, and spirit at the Seder. That's what you want. Because then you can actually get into the idea of being a slave. And being grateful for not being a slave, and then at the end, praising Hashem for the good fortune that we, the Jewish people, have, even though we have difficulties. Yes, Eitan. Jerry, don't you understand that one? That would say that's a takeaway. You're looking for your moment. Now, if you're not the Seder leader, that's a little bit touchy because you don't want to be called that the Seder hijacker. Hey, who made you the asset? You want to be a little bit the dilemma. Would you mind if I raise the, share a story and ask a question? Or talk to the Seder leader in advance? I have something I want to share. I want to hear people's thoughts about that. If you can get everybody off the script, off the got a script, into a conversation, that's what you want. Now, people have a very limited, you got to know your crowd. If people are going like, if y'all watch around you over here, they're giving you the signal like the Oscar when they start playing the music. Okay. You got to be loyal to know when there's time to get off the stage. Okay. Yes. Eitan, question. The issue is not really humans or things, because as long as you still have freedom of soul, You express your free will. You can live a moral, ethical life. You're still not a slave. You are a free person whose parts of their life is restricted, but you essentially, as a soul, are not restricted. No, you're not a slave at all. My point, I know what the rabbi said. These guys, even though they're being carted off by the Nazis, are not slaves. They're being not paid for their work, and they're being controlled viciously by Nazis, but they are free people. No, but going back to what Jamie said, but if they become, you know, so crushed that they are not, they become like an animal, like Viktor Frankl, if you read the book, Social Meeting, people became like, did horrible things. They did lose their humanity. And that person did become a thing. But the blessing was not about individual persons, about the Jewish people were granted, are categorically been gifted the ability to not be a slave. You're not a slave. The fact that a tragic Jew was crushed by the immense pressure, and we're not going to judge them being in a concentration camp, and did evil things like, you know, to get, you know, to survive. We're not going to judge that person. That person may have lost. That person may not have been. That person was became an animal, essentially, a slave to their animality. But the blessing was not created for them. It was formulated about the Jewish people. And we as a people have not, we're not intrinsically, we've already been removed from slavery. Well, we've been removed from slavery physically and spiritually and to the end of time. Eitan, a question. When?
Like, if this bracha were around during the time of slavery in Egypt.
Oh, could they say, could the Jews in Egypt say that bracha?
Yeah.
No, they could not.
What about, could you say that Hashem did not make them slaves?
Well, I'll tell you this. If you want a really nuanced question, to add another Seder nugget at it, I would say like this. One tribe of the Jewish people could say the blessing, and the other tribe could not say it. Which tribe would be able to say the blessing fully? Wasn't Cohen is not a tribe. What tribe is the Cohen? Levi. Why? Because the Midrash says the tribe of Levi never did idolatry in Egypt. The other 11 tribes did. They were not. They sort of remained as sort of spiritual leaders, and they did not fall into assimilation like the brothers did. So I say they never became enslaved psychologically, spiritually, while their other brothers did.
Wait, so Rabbi, does that mean I can't say that bracha?
No, why? That's what we're talking. His question was, if in the time of, could the Jews in Egypt say this blessing?
Okay, so it's, okay,
I was
good.
Saying that the other Jews could not because they were slaves, both physically and spiritually, while the rest of people were completely idolatrous and assimilated, they could not. Okay,
okay.
We're up to we're not going to cover all. No problem.
I'm a Levi, so I was curious.
Yes, no, that means you come from a distinguished the Levi tribe has always been a tribe who have had a measure of spiritual distinctiveness. Okay, we continue. All right. The third thing, Vehish Amda, one of the classic songs, Vehish Amda. Everybody likes that song.
Vehish Amda.
Right, the relatively new, the old one is Vehish Amda, Vehish Amda. That's the old style one, and the relatively new one from Yaakov Shweki is. Okay, so beyond the song, and by the way, I encourage you to definitely have singing at your Seder. You don't want to be dry experience. Remember, body, spirit, and soul. Okay, so just the English here. And the covenant is what stood for our fathers and for us. For not one alone stood against us to destroy us, but for rather each and every generation do they stand against us to destroy us. And the Holy One, blessed be He, saved us from their hand. So I think nowadays, I think we, the Jewish people living in April 2024, feel this passage of the Haggadah extremely clearly. We feel everywhere we turn, the level of anti-Semitism is just growing by leaps and bounds. This passage has not been, feels more true. Well, unfortunately, it's been about, which gets to a question, which is another Seder nugget. What is the cause of the eternity of anti-Semitism? Right, this Vehi Shamda is claiming that anti-Semitism is really like a law of nature. It every generation. It doesn't skip a generation. It says every generation. And we, ladies and gentlemen, are in such a generation. We see, just right, if you were, they had, what's happening now is that they're having Palestinian, pro-Palestinian protests in front of synagogues like in New Jersey, B'nai Ashurin. Some synagogues are having, let's say, real estate fairs about buying an apartment or property in Israel. And they come and protest against that. So they're having that same thing coming up in the five towns coming soon. So they already have one already. So it's just the question is, it's another nugget. What's the cause? You can ask the question. You get to this part. Okay, what's the cause of the eternity of anti-Semitism? That is an important question. So what do you guys say? Why is anti-Semitism not going away? Because if you're going to say it's Christian-based, because we killed deicide, we killed the Jesus, even though the New Testament says the Romans killed Jesus, but leaving that fact out. But there was anti-Semitism in Haman. There was no Christianity. There's a pagan anti-Semitism. And not only is it Christianity, it's also Islamic anti-Semitism. And the Soviet Union, they're atheists. There's atheistic anti-Semitism.
So, whatever the prevailing culture is.
But it seems to be, but there are many things, not everything, there is always a mainstream thing. It doesn't seem that the Jews seem to be getting an enormous amount of vicious, aggressive, violent pushback. Not just we're in the counterculture. There's something going on here. What is that? So some people say, oh, the Jews, they're too successful. They're lording over their success. Well, that definitely doesn't make things help. That definitely makes people jealous and envious. The Jews control the media. The Jews control the money, the banking system. All right. Factually, there are many Jews who are heads of studios and heads of media and also banking.
Fortune 500 companies, yeah.
Right, but it doesn't mean that there is that they all meet like in a secret society and now like how are we going to, not like in a some sort of like a Marvel movie, how they're all planning to in a conspiratorial manner come and attack everybody else. So what's the deal? How do you explain it? I mean, and the truth is
they need something to hate.
But
because
why
of their
the Jew?
Own insecurities?
But why the Jew? Pick some. Why are we picked on? There are other people who are hated, but we seem to be like we're caught everybody. I think most American Jews were caught off guard after October 7th when they would expect a tremendous amount of sympathy about the brutal Holocaust-like attack that 1,200 Israelis were butchered, raped, beheaded, and burnt, and then already people saying that it's the Jews' occupation of Gaza that caused it. We were responsible for our own demise. Okay? So people were like shocked. As you know, my day job, I work with the OU's JLIC. We have a situation where we have students, Jewish students, who are in college dormitories where their roommate is putting, posting on Instagram pro-Palestinian things, and they are they're living in the same room. That's uncomfortable. And the thing is, I can't do it. I can't live with such a person. You basically hate me. You're basically, Intifada Revolution, basically saying, you want to kill me. You basically gas the Jews. You're basically saying, so I can't live, so that becomes. I understand that. So that caught everybody by surprise, which means that people didn't really want to believe of the eternity about the anti-Semitism. In other words, if you believe in the eternity of the anti-Semitism, you wouldn't have been surprised. The fact that you were surprised means that you don't really believe that. You didn't really believe the Haggadah. Okay? So, yeah, Zeke.
Very, very dumb question.
No dumb questions here. Well, yes. We're talking about Paro attacking the Jews. Well, the question is that, that's a good question. That itself is a good question. In other words, is Paro's another, not, you will just create another knock, a Seder nugget. Is Paro's enslavement of the Jews anti-Semitism?
They came to the land and then they're successful. And
yes.
The Pharaoh became fearful of them?
Yes. Yes. It says, we said we should deal wisely with them because our enemy, they're growing up, they're growing numerously, and they're going to join our enemies, and they're going to kick us out of the land. Is that anti-Semitism? Was Paro an anti-Semite? Good question. What do you say? Another knock. We're adding more knocks on the shit. What do you say?
Yeah, but I think that. Today, and I'm not sure I will answer, I would say partially, but also Paro was controlling a huge empire. So his whole idea was to have everybody under his dominion, whether you were from, black from Egypt or wherever, or whatever. His whole idea was control over everything and everybody, and that was not specific to
you. Correct. You can make a very good case, as Diane is making. He wasn't anti-Semitic. He wants to control the subject of his people. In other words, in a certain sense, everybody's a slave to Paro. Even his own people, they're taxing them, control them, because he's a tyrant. If you're an authoritarian society, whoever's people in North Korea, are they slaves? They're all slaves to the Kim family, right? So I would differentiate. There are two kinds of anti-Semites. Because there's not just one flavor of anti-Semites. There's more than one flavor of anti-Semites. There's a Paro flavor. I'm going to complain, Eitan, give you a second. There's a Paro flavor, and there's a Haman flavor. The Paro flavor is that fundamentally, he's concerned about his empire. And he felt that these people threaten his empire, so therefore he's going to control them, even do a genocide, all the boys will be thrown to the Nile. Okay? But fundamentally, he cared about their labor. The most scary kind of anti-Semite is the Hitlerian anti-Semite, the Haman anti-Semite. What's that position? What's the main distinction between Haman, Hitler, and Paro?
I know of Haman, he was angry because we wouldn't bow to him. I think Hitler was like, they're different.
Is it just different? Is being just different is that he's going to set up an entire, use all of his resource to exterminate? It's not just because they're other. He maintained that the Jews, biologically, is the enemy of the Aryan race. He cannot tolerate, if there are Jews, he cannot be supreme. In order to have supremacy of the Aryan race, there has to be his empire, the Third Reich, from at its peak, from France deep into the Soviet Union, and everybody had to be what they call Judenrein, Jew free. And since nobody's going to take the Jews because none of the Western cultures did take the Jews, then what they happened? We have to kill them. In other words, and what's the deal? I will even lose their work. Because you had 11 million Jews under put them all to work. what they did initially. Put them all to work factories. You're fighting a war against the Allies. You need somebody to make munitions and build tanks and planes. Put them to work, slave labor, which they did for a time. But this hatred was so ideological. Intrinsically, I cannot tolerate the existence of a Jew. And I'm willing to do what? Hurt myself financially to get rid of the Jew. That's Haman. That's Hitler. It's not Paro. So much so that he's, as you know, Hitler toward the end is fighting a two-front war against the Allies in the West and against the Soviet Union in the East. And he's still using precious trains and armed forces to ship, to transport hundreds of thousands of Jews to the death camps. Auschwitz was killing 16,000 Jews per day. Per day. Now, he could not really, even if he does, he could not afford, that was a dumb move strategically. He should have not used all those trains. He should use those trains to transport munitions and troops to fight the war against the Soviets and against the thing. But he's willing to lose the war to kill the Jews. That's the worst enemy. That's the ideological enemy. Now, one could make the case that, which gets into my question, I'm going to skip a little bit. It's question number, just take a peek at number 7. Okay. In what way is Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza, a much more dangerous enemy than Paro? So it's what category of anti-Semite would you put Yahya Sinwar, who is the leader of Hamas in Gaza? Is he in the Paro variety or more toward the Haman variety, and why? Right, why, how, yeah, why, yeah, why so? Okay.
I mean, you know, Hitler was a gangster, basically. Like, he seized power. And
okay.
NDR was a gangster. He seized power in his land, and he did war.
But, so both are true, but it's who is more dangerous to the Jews? A Yahya Sinwar or a Paro?
Sinwar.
Why?
Well, I think he's like the Haman type, because he's willing to watch Gaza be, you know, bombed. He's willing to set up, you know, rocket launchers from people's homes, from schools. He's willing to put individual, you know, Palestinians in danger for his own personal vengeance, for his own personal mission.
1,000%. He's willing to lose his own people, tens of thousands of his own people, so he can inflict a tremendous wound against the state of Israel, because he wants one goal, that Israel should be Jew free. There should be no state of Israel. It should be an Islamic land.
Mm-hmm. You said that there'll be peace once they, you know, hate, like they care more about their people than they hate us or something.
Correct.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, because his goal is to, his strategy is that by having when there are the casualties of war, that when the civilians are killed, and therefore the Western world is coming down on Israel and dramatically, he's winning because he's undermining Israel's prestige in the world stage. And in many ways, Yahya Sinwar is winning. Yeah, he's currently living in a tunnel far under Rafah, but in many ways, as far as his goals are concerned, to weaken Israel, and therefore he's more dangerous, because Paro did not want to lose his, he wants the Jews to build his treasure houses, build his, he wants it for to build his economy. He doesn't care about it. He doesn't intrinsically despise the Jew intrinsically. Now, there are parts of the Jews that there's indicated the Egyptians, they couldn't eat with the Jews because they ate, that says that the Unkla says Jews were The Egyptians, by the way, were vegetarian, and the Jews would eat meat, which would be part of their god, part of their pantheon of gods. So they couldn't tolerate them. But they didn't have an ideological hatred that they must kill Jews. Yahya Sinwar will send out jihadist people to will lose their life to kill Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So that is so therefore Yahya Sinwar is a much more dangerous individual. Now, the goal, of course, is that if we can, he can be, if the IDF can quickly break the command and control structure of the brigades, which remain in Gaza, and just have to be onto a long-term insurgency mode where they're fighting individual terrorists, not great, but that will still be an improvement. So going back to Bahisha Amda, so this is the reality of Bahisha Amda. Okay, so so the eternity of anti-Semitism, if you know, the long, let me give the shortest answer I can give. Not quite 18 seconds. But I'm going to give it into under 60 seconds. The Talmud says that a play on the word of Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, where the Torah was given. The Torah was given at Sinai, Sinna bal Olam, Sinna. Mm-hmm. Hatred came to the world, which means that once the Jewish people entered into a covenant at Sinai, which made them the Mamlechet Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, that automatically created a measure of jealousy and hatred because it made the people feel inadequate, and they have to destroy those people that make them feel low. So fundamentally, one could argue, in fact, Hitler in his many, many speeches, he says the Jews brought the concept of conscience to the world, and I want to remove that.
Right.
He viewed that was an evil. Right, but he viewed that but ideologically they brought through Christianity, he ruined that the Jews ruined Europe, and he wants, so therefore that's really, where did conscience come from? That comes from the values of the Torah that are from Judaism and went into Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Love your fellow Jews yourself, all these different things. So he wanted to shut that down. Okay, so
I think it's written out, the Elders of Zion.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's a good conversation. So let me just pause on that point. So that's a very good conversation to have around the Hisha Amda. Sing the song and then say, well, this is saying that in every generation has come to rise us. Why do they hate us so much? That's a good conversation. Now, I'm not saying we have that conversation for 15 minutes. Maybe we're going to have it maybe for 7 minutes. But that's a good Seder nugget. That's a winner Seder nugget. Or do it like this. Compare, don't go to that, do a different angle. We'll make it a little bit. Which is the worst enemy of the Jews? Yahya Sinwar or Paro? Compare and contrast. Just that and then have a conversation. So that's a short question. So that's a good way to, and then people can weigh in. So that's a good way to spice up your Seder. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to, Tom, could you read this? I'm going to make it a little bigger. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik's comment on the Yisha Amda. I'm going to make this bigger.
Sure.
I'll read it out if you can.
It says that as an introduction to Arami Oved Avi, we raise our cup and say, this promise that sustained our ancestors is always a pharaoh or somebody worse who is possessed by psychopathic, cruel, bloodthirsty hate. Only the steady vigilance of the Almighty has saved us from complete annihilation. We celebrate the festival of Yitziat Mitzrayim, not only because we remember it, nor just because we re-experience it, but rather because it is a permanent drama. Every generation lives through this actual experience. Yitziat Mitzrayim. Hence, before we start reciting, commenting on, and explaining the Parsha of Arami Oved Avi, we inform the listener that our method is one of total interpretation, of translating the past into the present, of identifying memory with reality. The Parsha tells us that we are lonely people, that we are all a band of wandering Armenians facing hostility, that our very existence is a miracle. The story of the Exodus is a story of our destiny. Yitziat Mitzrayim is relevant and worthy of remembering. We experience it in retrospection and feel worthy of giving thanks, we also recognize that it is the story of this generation for whose salvation we pray. We lift up the cup when we say Vishyam. In biblical Hebrew, the word kos, cup, symbolizes destiny. You anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. I will raise the cup of salvations. Raising the cup symbolizes that the Haggadah is the book of Jewish destiny.
Tom, that was the best reading that we've had. Now, just you should know, Tom does have some experience in the rules of radio. So we got a premium announcer reading of Reisel Vachik. So we appreciate the extra flourish there. But it's also a great quote that basically what Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, the Rav is saying here, is that basically Yetzirah Mitzrayim, the Exodus story is not about something that happened 3,300 years ago. We're in the drama now. Some years we don't feel it. Right now we feel it. And that's something there. And the goal is to translate the past to our present. So having a conversation like, compare and contrast Paro with Yichyeh Sinwar is basically a process of translating the past, the future. And in the Haggadah, we're going to actually talk about there is a Gula Mitzrayim, there's a redemption of Egypt, and there's a what we call a Gula Atida, an ultimate redemption, the Messianic era, which is something we talk about in the Hallel. Okay, we keep on going. I'm just going to do, next week I'll be in Israel. Coming back, so on the 17th, we'll do we'll do some more of this. Okay, so stay tuned. Maybe if I can sneak in one more. Okay, here we go. This is up Tom's another Tom. This is a Tom Weiss. Who is your favorite coach? Whether it be college or pro. Okay, now this could be a self. I don't know. Now the problem with if you have a lot of sports enthusiasts, that could be a 30-minute conversation. Okay. But who is your best coach of all time, be it in the college level sports or in pro sports? And what are this coach's special talents? So I'll take any suggestions from the crowd over here. What's the who's the best? Who's your favorite coach? Tom, you got a good one. Who's your favorite coach?
Well, you know I got to go with it. It's a young guy that is now the head of basketball operations, the president of the Boston Celtics. And the reason is because he was Butler University, where I went to school as head coach, where we went to back-to-back national championships as a tiny little Ivy League school of the Midwest, if there is such a thing as an Ivy League school of the Midwest. And it was unbelievable, the runs in 2010 and 2011. So his name is Brad Stevens. But outside of Brad Stevens, there are some great ones. If you look at Phil Jackson and his whole thought process, I mean, he's a very Jewish thought. By the way, he lived on the west side of Manhattan, 79th Street.
So now let's go a little bit. What? So let's go, Brad Stevens. Let's go to your alma mater, Baylor.
Butler.
Sorry, Butler.
And the second he went there, I was like, now I got to root for the Boston Celtics.
Right. What was his special talent as a coach?
He was able to see everything, to visualize, to break things down. He was actually one of the early analytics person. And yet didn't even get paid for it. He left a marketing company, Eli Lilly, a big pharmacy company, but was a marketing person for them. And he not only broke things down and saw things, but he related to the players very well. He was their age, basically. He was a little bit like 10 years older than they were. Yet at the same time, he could really relate. He could give it in terms, almost like as if somebody like a David Aram or something, you know, Rabbi David Aram of Israelite, would be able to, coming out of the conservative movement, saw different types of things and gave over and gives over the depths of Judaism, as far as the Zohar is concerned, as far as Kabbalah is concerned. And to be able to have that kind of insight and content, that's very much the Jewish people. We would love it if the world could actually break things down, especially the Ivy Leagues. It's ridiculous how shallow people that can actually get into Ivy League schools can be, that they don't go after the content a little deeper and then be able to reach people with things that they can understand rather than just kind of, my friend is marching over here, I'm getting paid to march. Doesn't make sense. Break it down. Look at the thing, look at the content, analyze the situation, figure out how to win.
Okay. So here now, the pivot question is, how was Hashem like your favorite coach during the Exodus? So how was Hashem really a coach in the Exodus? Now, most people think of the Exodus like the Jews are in Egypt. It's like Alcatraz, a penitentiary. And God opens up the door and then, all right, everybody out, run out. Okay, that's part of the story, but there was a coaching dimension. Who could tell me what was the coach dimension of the Exodus?
Moshe, like, the faith of himself.
Okay.
Follow through.
So you're saying him coaching a Moshe?
Moshe, okay, good. Giving him, like, motivation. Lots of strategy involved.
Excellent, excellent, good.
Ten plagues, like, here's what's going to happen with Pharaoh. And, right. Like, he's going to say yes, he's going to say no, then I'm going to have to save you, and I have to do this. So, like, okay. Lots of strategy in mind.
Okay, so you're viewing it. Okay, good. In addition to that, he was also... Hashem functioned as a coach for the Jewish people because before they left, they didn't just leave. They had to do two mitzvot. What are the two mitzvot? Korban Pesach, number one, the Passover offering, and number two? Nope. That's another mitzvah. That was for the leaders. Brit Milah. The Jews, as a whole, stopped doing Brit Milah. Yeah. Shocker, right? A shock. Okay, yeah, I got the good. So the Jewish people got completely assimilated to Egypt, basically they completely doing their idolatry. Part of the idolatry of Egypt included worshiping the lamb, which channeled the power from the constellations, they believed. So by slaughtering the Passover offering in the middle of the day, roasting it all, invited the whole mishpacha to eat it, took a tremendous amount of courage because maybe the Egyptians were going to fight them. It also required them, they're going to have to reject the idolatry of Egypt publicly. In order to eat the Korban Pesach, they had to do what? They had to do a Brit Milah, which had to reconnect their connection to Avram. So basically, God made the Jewish people, coached the Jewish people to become worthy of redemption. We're getting quite a bit of a storm here. So the question is, that's the key thing. God is coaching the Jewish people, who are no different than the Egyptians, to be involved in self-redemption, to break from Egypt, to do the Passover offering, to do the Korban, to do the Brit Milah, which allowed them to be worthy of being redeemed. Or he didn't just redeem them, he coached them into become worthy of redemption by doing those two challenging, courageous mitzvahs. And by doing so, then they were eligible to leave. Okay? There's a midrash that says that during the plague of darkness, 4/5 of Jews died. Now, obviously, the midrash always uses an exaggeratory point. So that's the deal. So that's the deal. I gotta go because the rabbis told me that it's based time for me to take the next class. So we're gonna continue this next time. We did half the nuggets tonight, and we'll do another batch of nuggets on the way back. So you'll have plenty of Seder nuggets for your Seder, guys. All the best.
No class next week. Week after.
No, there's no class with me. We're gonna have I will message you who's gonna be the teacher.
Okay.
Rabbi, one of the highlights of last night was your davening, and with all these people that came together that were actually saying Kaddish at the same time. It's unbelievable. But that was one of the most powerful moments of the entire night. And of course, Leon Wilds.
It was a lovely night. Yeah.
It was special. It's very special.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, guys. Bye, Lato. Be well.